Welcome to Footsteps of the Fallen, a Great War podcast with me, battlefield researcher, historian and writer, Matt Dixon. For the last 30 years, I've been visiting the cemeteries, memorials and battlefields of the First World War. And in this series of podcasts, I'd like to take you on a journey through France, Belgium and further afield and tell you the stories of some of the places I visited and the stories of the men who lie as the dead of the Great War. So pack up your kit bag and join me as we walk the well-trodden paths on the battlefields, following in the footsteps of the fallen. It's a pleasure to have your company. So welcome to this latest episode of Footsteps of the Fallen. And as always, thank you very, very much indeed for joining me. It's a real pleasure to have your company, whether this is Sunday morning or sometime later in the week that you're listening to the podcast. You're very welcome to be here. And we've had lots of new listeners over the last couple of weeks, which is fantastic. And thank you very much to those of you who have tuned into the podcast for the first time. And if you are one of those new listeners, then you are very welcome. It's a pleasure to have your company. And if you're one of our seasoned campaigners who's coming back to listen to another episode and does so every week, then thank you very, very much indeed for your continued support. And on the subject of support, we were delighted to have a new supporter via buymeacoffee.com. And I'd like to say thank you very much to Rusty Canadian for the incredibly generous donation that he made via Buy Me a Coffee. It all goes towards helping the cost of producing the podcast and hosting it and the website and that sort of thing. And he actually contacted me via Twitter to ask a question on the basis of the podcast that we produced about Festubert a couple of weeks ago, and it was a real pleasure to be able to help him with his research. He's got a trip planned over to the Western Front, including walking the battlefield at Festubert, which I'm obviously very jealous about. I'd love to be over there joining him at that time, but it was real nice to be able to help somebody, and particularly a listener who'd been inspired by the podcast that we produced, to reach out and contact me directly. So Rusty, thank you very much indeed for your donation. It's a real pleasure, as I say, to have you as a supporter of the podcast. And when we look at the podcast we've released, obviously last weekend's episode was the interview with Rory Forsyth. We were talking about the Western Front Way project, and it's I don't think I've recorded a podcast that's generated so much interest and so many questions on social media about the project and the way the project is moving forward and that sort of thing. And it hasn't been possible to reply to everybody, but I think really what I would say to anyone who listened to the podcast and has got questions that you would like to hear answered that maybe weren't covered in the interview that we did, then please reach out to the Western Front Way directly. I'm sure that they would be absolutely delighted to help you. And as I say, it's not possible to cover every question that was raised in just an hour's podcast. But Rory's a very approachable chap, and I'm sure would be more than happy to communicate directly with anyone who has an interest in the project and what's happening with it. So I would encourage you, as I said, if you do have any questions, then please address them directly with the Western Front Way. So we've reached the midway point of season four of the podcast, and we had the fantastic news in the last couple of weeks that we've reached over 300,000 downloads since the podcast was begun in August 2020. It's absolutely remarkable, and I thank every single one of you. It certainly never expected anything at all like this when I began the podcast back then, and it's quite interesting actually to go back and listen to some of the earlier episodes, and you realise sort of things like sound quality and editing and the quality of the microphone you were using compared to now is very, very different. But thank you to every single one of you who's downloaded an episode. It really does help, and as I said, to hit that incredible number of 300,000 downloads is quite remarkable, say, for an amateur historian. When you think of the huge dearth of historical and Great War podcasts that are out there, excellent podcasts done by some very, very eminent historians, it's very humbling, and I'm very honoured to have had so many downloads. So thank you to each and every single one of you. As I said, we're halfway through season four. We're going to obviously carry on through the summer. It'll take us through into the autumn, and then we'll have our usual customary break at the end of the season, and we are planning on coming back with season five in due course. So what's been going on at Footsteps HQ in the last week? Well, it's a very exciting time. So I've just literally finished this morning the final edits to the book that I have going to be publishing with my good friend Simon Batten, which will be published by Helion, going to be out in October. And we've just literally done the final proofreading, corrections and editing, and I've seen the first draft of the cover, which is very impressive, looks really good, very excited about that, and I look forward to telling you more about it in due course when we know when it's going to be released and that sort of thing. And I've been working quite hard actually as well on producing the publisher's requests and publisher's information for my second book on the Battle of Festubert. That's almost completed and should be going through to Helion in the next few days, and hopefully we'll have some good news to tell you about over the coming weeks, and I'll keep you updated with how that project is going along. But far more important than that, where are we in today's journey through the footsteps of the fallen? Well, one of the really exciting things about this fabulous period of history that we're all interested in is that every day is a school day. You always learn something new. And I was having a look through Google the other day, and I came across an article in a newspaper that was talking about the Victoria Cross and most Victoria Crosses that have been awarded in a single day's combat. And this got me thinking about the award of the VC during the First World War. So those of you who are regular listeners to the podcast will know that I quite often talk about Victoria Crosses, if they're were awarded in the particular action that we're looking at, or the particular area that we're focusing on. And obviously, when one thinks of large numbers of VC awards, obviously got the first day of the Somme and the famous occasion at Gallipoli, where there were the six VCs before breakfast to the men of the Lancashire Fusiliers when they landed on the peninsula. But as part of the sort of background research that I was doing when I sort of got thinking about this award of VCs, I came across the story of the Canadian Army and the fighting on the 2nd of September 1918. And it was during this fighting, in an attempt to capture the infamous Drocourt-Queant line, that the men of the Canadian Army won no less than seven Victoria Crosses in a single day. And in today's episode, we're going to head over to eastern France and have a look at what happened on that day in September 1918 and tell the stories of the seven Victoria Cross winners. We're also going to be having a look at the Hindenburg Line, the enormous German defensive structure that was being attacked by the Canadians at this particular juncture in the fighting. What was it? How did it come to pass, and how was it built, and that sort of thing. So without further ado, let's begin our journey through No Ordinary Monday. When the Great War began in 1914, the Germans found themselves along almost the entire length of the Western Front in the advantageous position of holding the majority of the high ground. And this was an opportunity that they didn't waste, either tactically or strategically. And it's something that we've looked at a lot in these podcasts. It's about the skill of German engineering in terms of creation of defensive positions along the length of the Western Front. So they were experts at using the terrain to their advantage and building these almost impregnable sort of defences along the length of the front line. And the construction of the defences in the vast majority of places along the Western Front was such that it relied on very, very heavy and very accurate British artillery to stand any chance whatsoever of successfully capturing the defensive lines and the defensive positions that the Germans had constructed. And I suppose actually when you think about it, it's this expertise in sort of scientific engineering is no surprise. It's a very Germanic sort of trait when you look at their skills as designers and as engineers. But when you look at the Western Front, there is probably nowhere that provides a better example of the skills of German military planning when it came to the construction of defensive fortifications than that of the Hindenburg Line. The line was known to the Germans as the Siegfriedstellung or the Siegfried Line, and it was constructed in the late autumn, winter and spring of 1916 going into 1917. And the line itself ran from just outside the city of Arras on the southern edge of Artois across northern France towards the city of Soissons, located on the River Aisne. And the construction of the line itself owes its birth, I suppose we would say, to the mauling that the Germans had suffered on the Western Front in 1916. They'd suffered very, very heavy casualties through the fighting at not only Verdun, but also on the Somme as well. And they really weren't in a position to be sort of renewing another offensive like this. So a decision was taken that they were going to withdraw to a newly constructed series of defensive positions. And this was to be accompanied by a policy, I suppose we'd know it as a scorched earth, that when they retreated back across the battlefield, they destroyed everything in their path that could be of any use to the Allies behind them. And the idea really was that it was to delay the Allies long enough that they wouldn't be able to launch another offensive on the Western Front until the spring of 1917. Because as 1916 came to a close, the Germans found themselves in a very, very perilous situation. They'd obviously suffered very, very high casualties in the fighting on the Somme and at Verdun, but they were still in this position that they really didn't want to be in, of having to fight a war on two fronts. That obviously had the conflict against the British and the French in France and Belgium, but they also had the added problem at this particular moment in time that the so-called Brusilov offensive that had taken place over in the east had caused a significant damage to the army of Austria-Hungary, and the Germans were forced to take over large sections of the line to kind of make up for the problems that this failure of the offensive had caused. And they also had another situation that was causing both a sort of economic, political and military problems for them, was that when Romania declared war against Germany, it meant that already sort of fairly scarce resources and scarce finances were having to be stretched even thinner than possible. So the last thing that the Germans really needed after the problems that they'd had in 1916 was to be fighting yet another large scale offensive. So the idea really was to sort of move back to this newly prepared defensive line, which is kind of it's almost like a sort of guarantee, like an insurance policy against a resumption of the Somme offensive by the British and the French in case that happened during the winter of 1916 or spring of early 1917. The decision to retreat to the Hindenburg Line was codenamed by the Germans as Operation Alberic. And it's something that we've dealt with in a previous podcast. If you haven't had the chance to listen to that, please have a look back through the previous episodes and you will find the podcast where we talk at length about what happened during the withdrawal. And whilst I suppose one could argue that the withdrawal to the Hindenburg Line was something of a tactical masterstroke on the part of the Germans, this is a policy of scorched earth that they adopted was rigorously enforced. And when the Germans pulled back, they literally destroyed everything that was left behind so that the advancing British and French armies could find nothing in the landscape that could be of any possible use to them during the fighting and during the pursuit of the Germans. But what this was something of, I suppose one would say, kind of a two-edged sword, because obviously what it did is it did deprive the Allies of masses of useful supplies and damage to the infrastructure of France and that sort of thing. But what it did is the utterly sort of ruthless enforcement of this policy of scorched earth actually cost Germany many of the few friends that they had left sort of diplomatically, because the scale of the kind of wanton destruction that was left by the German army was absolutely sort of unprecedented in warfare. And the treatment of French civilians, I think, was probably best be described as sort of barbaric in the extreme. And what this did is it made Germany even more of a pariah than it had already become. And I suppose it's one of those difficult things to do in, you know, when you're faced with a warfare situation, you have certain decisions that get made that you make them militarily and strategically for the right reasons, but in enacting them, it causes sort of problems politically and through support from your allies. A very difficult situation to be in, but there's no doubt whatsoever that the scorched earth policy that Germans had was incredibly effective. As I say, the French civilian population that found themselves in the way of this sort of German juggernaut really paid a very, very unhappy price. And there is a certain degree, I always think this, there's a certain degree of irony in the choice of name for Operation Alberic. Alberic, of course, was the malevolent dwarf king from German mythology. If any of you have listened to the Nibelung, the Ring Cycle by Richard Wagner, a character appears in there. And as I said, he was sort of a very malevolent character and was characterized in his battles with the gods by this sort of trail of destruction that Alberic left wherever he went. And it's sort of very appropriate but slightly ironic choice of name when you think about what the Germans did as they were retreating back through France. The construction of the Hindenburg line came on the back of a period of absolutely sort of unprecedented change in the domestic and political situation within Germany itself. The German government had passed what was called the Auxiliary Service Law. And what this meant was it saw that all men from the ages of 16 to 50 were forced into sort of compulsory service. And it meant as well that there were vast changes were made to German industry, and particularly the production of war-related materials with that munitions, armaments, and above all, machine guns. And the government had set very, very ambitious targets to increase industrial production by almost 80%. And the manufacture of machine guns was to treble throughout 1916, because obviously they saw the benefit of well-sighted machine guns all across the Western and Eastern fronts. And to say this this program of industrial development really, really took hard. And this was done at the sacrifice of large numbers of other industries. And this was a country, of course, that was suffering very, very heavily from economic sanctions that had been put into place by other governments as a result of the war, and of course the blockade of German ports, which led to the problems of food supply and that sort of thing. But say the Germans could never be accused of being anything other than ambitious, and say these targets for this massive increase in massive development of industrial production all came at the same period of time when the decision was made to construct the Hindenburg line behind the existing front. Germany also changed very much its position in terms as to sort of reinforcing its army. By 1916, they had almost 1.2 million men in reserve. There was about 800,000 men who were in reserve, and then there was about another 400,000 who were part of what was called the conscript class. But the German government took precautions to ensure that the industrial workforce was intact, and there were almost a million men were put into reserved occupations, which meant they were exempt from military service. But they obviously had a very heavy burden placed on them with this attempt to try and sort of increase munitions production. And the problem that the Germans had is that the production of effective munitions required large amounts of chemicals. And before the war and up to this point, Germany relied very heavily on importing chemicals from abroad. And of course, with the sanctions and the embargoes that had been placed on them from an economic and political perspective by the other belligerents during the Great War were really taking hold. And they found themselves in a very, very difficult situation because they couldn't, the supply of chemicals rather didn't match the demand that they were trying to do. So German chemists were in sort of race to try and work out ways to be able to manufacture the chemicals they needed for munitions working themselves without having to rely on importing the said items. And one of the things that the Germans had in their advantage in 1916 was that they had huge, huge reserves of artillery shells. At the beginning of 1916, they had almost 8 million shells in reserve, about 5 million shells for field guns and about 3 million shells for heavy artillery. But the problem was that when the decision was taken to launch the Verdun offensive, the Germans fired in the first 2 weeks of the offensive almost 4 million shells, almost half of their reserve. And then, of course, they'd been through the fighting on the Somme as well. And what this meant was that whilst they were not by any stretch of the imagination at crisis point, they had significantly depleted their reserves of artillery. So, of course, this was another factor that contributed towards the thinking about why it was necessary to perform this withdrawal back to the Hindenburg line and avoid at all possible costs to be drawn into another sort of attritional slog against the British or the French on the Western Front. The German defensive line building process that took place across the Western Front was divided into five distinct sections of defensive line that ran from the coast of Belgium down through into France, across the northern France and towards eastern France. And the most northerly of these defensive lines that was built, the first was called the Flanders Stellung, and this ran from the coast of Belgium down to the city of Lille. It ran behind the Passchendaele and the Messines ridges. And then when it got down to Lille, it was then handed over to what was known as the Wotan Line. And this was named after Odin, the famous Norse god, which played a big part in German mythology. And it was known, this part of the defensive line was known to the British as the Drocourt Queant line. And it's this that we're going to look at later when we look at the fighting of the Canadians. And then as you went further south, they say the Wotan line ran from Lille down to towards the city of Soissons. It ran behind the Artois battlefields of 1915, of Neuve-Chapelle and Aubers and Loos, and then ran behind the Somme battlefields that had been fought over throughout the summer of 1916. And so when it got down to Soissons, it then turned into what was called the Siegfried Stellung, or that was known as the Hindenburg line to the British. And this was a defensive structure, probably the most formidable of all of the five German defensive positions on the Western Front, that ran across what was called the Noyon Salient. And this was a bulge in the line that ran from the town of Neuville-Saint-Vaast, just to the southeast of Arras, and went down towards Selny on the Chemin des Dames ridge over in the east of France, going out towards Champagne. And it then turned into what's called the Hundungstellung, which went from Peronne down to the northeast of Verdun, covered across the Champagne battlefields where there'd been all the fighting in 1915. And then finally it turned into the Michaelstellung, which ran from the town of Etang down to Pont-à-Mousson and ran behind the area around Saint-Mihiel in the east of France. So it's a formidable piece of engineering. We'll look at the challenges of the construction of this defensive line very shortly. When the decision was made to construct the Hindenburg line, the German Air Force undertook what was at that time the greatest feat of aerial surveillance that had ever been taken. German aircraft managed to survey the entire length of the Western Front, and they photographed every single inch of it. And quite a remarkable achievement when you think about sort of the problems of technology and how cumbersome cameras were at this particular time. But what this did was it enabled them to choose the best positions to site this new piece of defensive engineering, and also keep tabs on what the British and French were doing, where there were concentrations of troops that were building up for an impending offensive. And once the land had been surveyed and the decisions had been made as to the construction of the Hindenburg line, it was passed on to a man by the name of Colonel Heinrich Kramer. Now, he was the chief engineering officer at German Supreme HQ. He had been a professor of civil engineering at the University of Stuttgart before the war broke out. And he was the man that was given the monumental task of coordinating this construction of this enormous defensive work across the length of Northern Europe. The main building works were given to the massive German engineering company Ruprecht and Kohl, and they exported large quantities of workers from Germany to work on the construction project. And one of the notable features that the Germans did when they were building the line was they made great use of reinforced concrete structures, these huge, great big, thick concrete reinforced with steel. And these sort of structures dominated the lines. In fact, many of them still exist today. As you travel across France, you can still see them. It gives some idea of the strength of these constructions that were put along the length of the Western Front, that nearly over a century later, they're still there in many, many places. And say there were thousands of workers were shipped from Germany to come and sort of help work on the construction project. And the Germans also used thousands of Belgian and German labourers. But they also, in a sort of slightly foreshadowing way of what was to happen during the Second World War, they used 50,000 Russian soldiers who'd been taken prisoner of war in the fighting on the Eastern Front and employed them as, I suppose one would almost say, slave labour to construct this defensive work. And I think the scale of what the Germans undertook from an engineering point of view can't be underestimated. It was, at that particular moment in time, the largest construction project on Earth. And the Hindenburg line itself, sort of, which was, say, the most formidably defended of the five sections, of which the Drocourt-Queant line was sort of the northern part, was a real sort of feat of civil engineering. The line itself, the Hindenburg line, ran for approximately 90 miles, and it was designed in such a way that it could be held by 20 divisions, or one division every 4.5 miles. And the problems of building something on this sort of scale were such that the project itself used the entire supply of sand, gravel and cement in the whole of occupied France and Belgium, as well as all the supplies that Germany had available to it. So obviously had a sort of knock-on impact, particularly for Germany, projects that may have been going on in Germany that had to be put on hold because all of supplies were being diverted to construct the Hindenburg line along northern France. It was an incredible feat of logistics and organisation. The vast majority of supplies were transported either by canal or by railways. And during the construction of the line itself, over 1,200 train loads of building supplies were delivered, and each train was almost a mile in length. So to give you some idea of the huge amount of infrastructure and quantity of materials that were needed. And what the Germans did while they were building this, they were very, very technologically advanced, and they made use, I suppose, of what we would probably recognise now as prefabricated structures, because what this did is it made it much, much easier for them to be constructed on the battlefield. So all artillery emplacements, dugouts, machine gun posts were all the same size, and they were made of prefabricated concrete slabs, which could be simply put together by engineers on the battlefield. And all the timber that was used in construction was assembled almost, I suppose, like a First World War equivalent of flat pack furniture, that it was very, very simple to be put together on the battlefield. And it simply meant that it could be constructed very, very quickly. What you didn't want to do was obviously be involved in the engineering of building materials actually on the front line itself. So this development of this kind of prefabricated building structures was really innovative for its time, and I'd say sort of testament to German ingenuity and engineering. One of the problems of all First World War battlefields revolved around the issues of communication. It was almost impossible to keep telephone cables from being cut by artillery. So to tackle this, the Germans buried all of their communication and power cables very, very deep in the earth and installed them in sort of steel conduits that were buried many meters underground. So even with the explosion of heavy shells, it was unlikely to cause sort of significant damage to their communications and their power supplies. I saw something that I'm sure was very gratefully received by those soldiers who were occupying the lines and had cause to need this form of power or communication during the heat of a battle. running behind the Hindenburg line were hundreds of miles of light railways, which were used to transport supplies around behind fighting areas. And once again, these were all kind of prefabricated. So if there was damage done to them, either by shell fire or something like that, it was very simple just to bolt new pieces of track down and be able to restore sort of transport and logistics very, very, very quickly indeed. And the way that the line was constructed were two parallel lines of trenches. The first line was about 200 meters in front of the second line. And the idea that the Germans sort of put when they were building this defensive structure was that the front line itself could be held very, very lightly. It was usually garrisoned only by sentry troops. And the main defensive line, say, was this second line that was some 200 meters or so behind the first one. And what they had done is that they had dug deep down into the ground, and they produced this sort of troglodyte world of enormous dugouts, concrete dugouts made of reinforced concrete with very, very deep and multiple entrance points. So if one entrance got blocked, there was always another way to get out. And these were built of such a size that an entire company could rest inside a particular dugout. And it offered a real degree of sort of protection from British and French artillery, something that must be very, very welcomed by the men who inhabited this. So this sort of strange kind of troglodyte world that developed under the Hindenburg line. One of the things that the Germans did particularly heavily around the Hindenburg and Drocourt-Queant line was made use of huge industrial quantities of barbed wire. When the fortifications were built, there were belts of barbed wire that were in some places almost 100 meters deep. And what they did, a very, very clever piece of sort of engineering and planning, is that they divided the barbed wire up into sections of about 13 meters in length and about 5 meters in depth. And they zigzagged them, and they attached the barbed wire into the ground using screw pickets that sort of just corkscrewed into the ground. The barbed wire was put through them. It's something actually that if you walk the battlefields, it's this kind of classic battlefield artifact that one finds quite often still on the battlefields, and finds these sort of the corkscrew of the bottom of these pickets lying around. I've actually got a couple of them in my back garden that I brought back from the battlefield, and they are attaching a fence that I've got some flowers growing up and what have you. So it's nice that they're being sort of reused in that way. But what it did is it produced, to say, this zigzag of barbed wire, and it meant that the Germans could then cover the front and sides of the barbed wire emplacements with machine guns, which were well placed in the trenches, to be able to sort of like almost hose pipe the barbed wire and anyone who was unfortunate enough to be trying to attack it and pick their way through, say, this kind of crazy maze of 100 meter deep belt of barbed wire. The Drocourt-Queant line, or DQ line as it was known, was sat about 15 kilometres to the east of the city of Arras. And the actions of the 2nd of September were the culmination of about a week of fighting that the Canadians had been involved in, that culminated towards the end of what became known as the Battle of the Scarpe. And the 4th of August 1918 marked the date when there was 100 days left of the war. And it was during these 100 days that the Canadian infantry gained a real sort of reputation for themselves, and to cement even more the reputation they gained in 1917 with this successful capture of Vimy Ridge. And the Canadians were in action almost constantly for this kind of last 100 days. And to really understand the reasons behind the fighting to capture the Drocourt-Queant line, what we need to do is actually go back to the beginning of August and look at what happened in the Battle of the Scarpe, because it was the events there that led to the Canadians being in the position and being charged with the assault of capturing the Drocourt-Queant line itself. So at the beginning of August in 1918, the Canadian Corps was being commanded by a man by the name of Lieutenant General Sir Arthur Currie. And at that stage in the fighting, they had been attached to the British 4th Army, and they were involved in the what became known as the Battle of Amiens, which began on the 8th of August, and it was to offensive sort of on the Somme battlefield to capture the city of Amiens. And this was actually very successfully done, and the front was sort of secured, and there was a brief sort of period of rest and recuperation where the troops had a little bit of time to recover. But no sooner had they sort of taken a break than an order came through from Douglas Haig, who ordered the First Army, which the Canadians were part of, that they were going to push towards the east from the city of Arras. And as part of the sort of the wider plan for this offensive, the Canadians were given the job of capturing this sort of heavily defended area of the Drocourt-Queant line. And the plan really for them was that once they'd done this, they were then going to continue advancing eastwards, with their next objective being the Canal du Nord, which ran across, bisected this part of the battlefield. And it had actually been drained empty at this time of the fighting. So it presented a sort of really formidable obstacle. And if you could actually gain hold of it, there was a very useful location in which to be. When the fighting began, the Canadians were astride the main road that runs from sort of Arras down towards Cambrai. And on their left-hand side, they had men of the 51st Highland Division who had come under Currie's command at that particular moment in time. And they were on the left-hand side. The 3rd Canadian Division was in the middle, and then the 2nd Canadian was on the right down to the south of the main road. And as the assault took place as they left Arras, the men had actually been sheltering in Arras itself. There were a large number of sort of tunnels and caves under the city. And if you ever find yourself in Arras and have a little bit of time to kill, I highly recommend making a visit to the Carrière Wellington, which is the tunnels and the caves that are located under Arras. A really, really remarkable place to go and visit. And it's sort of a museum, and you can go around the cellars. It's a very atmospheric place, and so definitely one that if you have the chance to visit, then please do. Arras is an interesting town, actually. It's a nice place to sort of stop off, and there's some nice sort of restaurants and cafes and that sort of thing. The centre of Arras is very nice, and obviously a lot of great war history in the city itself. When the fighting began on the 8th, the first primary objective for the Canadians was the capture of the village of Monchy-le-Preux, which is something we looked at in a podcast earlier on in this series. And Monchy, you say, was on the side of a hill, and there were two hills on either side of it. So slightly smaller hills. First was Orange Hill, which was on the north, and then there was another hill called Chapel Hill on the south. And it was a very, very well executed plan, a very well executed operation. And both the hills actually fell really quite easily. And by about 8 o'clock in the morning, Monchy-le-Preux was in Canadian hands. And up to the north east of Monchy was the infamous scene of the chemical works at the village of Rouen, which had been the scene of some particularly brutal fighting throughout 1917 during the Battle of Arras. And this was successfully captured by men of the 51st Highland Division. And down to the south of the case, the 2nd Canadian Division, they were very successful as well. They captured the village of Guimepa and then into Wancourt. And by nightfall, they'd actually gone past Monchy-le-Preux and managed to move the line about a kilometre to the east of the town itself. So very, very successful start to the operation. Like with so many battles in the First World War, the initial success was tempered by sort of a very, very stiff German resistance. And over the 26th and 27th of August, there was some progress made, but the attack sort of petered out and ground to a halt. And by the 28th, the fighting had really become very, very severe. The 3rd Division were in real trouble in the middle. They'd used all of the brigades that they had available to try and break through an area called Bois-Notre-Dame. And the sort of progress, as I say, has halted. The 2nd Division were having equal problems. They were sort of held up by some very, very stiff German resistance. But they did manage to sort of push through. And over the period of 3 days, they actually managed to advance 8 kilometers, which when you think about what had happened for the previous 4 years, where advances could generally be measured in sort of tens of yards, to actually go forward nearly 6 miles, nearly 5 miles rather, is quite remarkable. And it was something that I wonder whether the troops were actually prepared for this, because they weren't used to making such a large advance. But the Canadians had been very, very successful. They captured over 3,000 German prisoners, but this had come at a very, very heavy price. They'd had over 6,000 casualties themselves. On the evening of the 27th, the 2nd Division was moved out of the line and they were relieved in the line by men of the 15th Battalion. This was made up of men from the 48th Highlanders of Canada Regiment. And they took over a section of line that they didn't know before and they hadn't been to before. And of course, with the sort of sudden movement that came on, men didn't actually really know where they were going. They were ordered to advance and take over the trench. And they, when they questioned, well, we don't actually know where the trench is, they were said basically just keep going east until you come to a trench with some men in it and that will be the front lines. Not a very helpful situation that they found themselves in. When they reached the front line, the men of the Highlanders set up their HQ in a location which was called Sun Quarry. And these were old German trenches. And the problem came that when they occupied the dugouts, the entrances to the dugouts now faced towards where the Germans were. And that on the evening of the 30th of September, there was a remarkably lucky escape for the senior officers of the battalion. They were in an old German dugout when a shell came straight down the entrance, down the stairs, and exploded inside the dugout. Now, miraculously, all it did was put all the lights out and damage a few pieces of crockery. But miraculously, the commanding officer and a group of officers and various other people, including a newspaper reporter, I think I'm correct, was embedded with them, actually all survived and sort of dusted themselves off. And this was very, very lucky because they were in the stage, actually, for them planning the next part of the operation that was due to take place on the 1st of September. And the Highlanders were ordered that they had to capture a position that was known as the Crow's Nest. And they also had another objective, which was called Chateau Wood, near the village of Hendecourt. And the sort of slow march eastwards was going very well, but there were a number of woods that stood in the way, and each of these woods had to be captured. And something we've looked at a lot in this podcast is that fighting in woods is very, very difficult, but it's very easy to defend, but very hard to attack against. And the men of the 1st Canadian Brigade moved up and they successfully captured Upton Wood, which was another of the woods that lay in the path of them. It's a very difficult fighting, kind of rolled backwards and forwards between the Canadians and the Germans until eventually at the end of the day, the Canadians had actually successfully taken the wood. And on the afternoon of the 31st, men of the Highlanders were told to go up and take over the German trenches that had been captured near a position that was known as Ulster Trench, and this was on the main road that ran down towards the village of Hendecourt, Le Canicourt. And it was here that they settled in for preparation for their assault against the Crow's Nest that was due to take place the next day. The Crow's Nest itself was a small hill that was sort of bristling with machine gun emplacements and barbed wire and kind of stumps of trees. And the men of the Canadians didn't really know what to expect or what the opposition was going to be. And they launched their attack in the early hours of the morning, about 3:30 in the morning. And they'd had an artillery bombard, which had landed on the hill. And the decision was made that since we don't really know what it is we're going into, we're actually just going to storm the hill. And storm the hill they duly did. And they were actually successful and managed to capture the position of the Crow's Nest, and then men continued to push forward into a sunken road which lay beyond the Crow's Nest down towards the village of Canicourt. They managed to push through and capture the Crow's Nest position and then head down towards the chateau, which stood there, a magnificent French chateau. It was going to be quite badly damaged during the fighting, but a sort of very recognisable landmark. But the problem that the Canadians had at this particular point of time was that they were their right-hand side was the very limit of the First Army. And over on their right, there was the attack against Hendecourt village that was going to be carried out by men of the 57th Division of the Third Army. And of course, wherever you have this boundary between large forces, there's always an element of confusion over who's where and who's responsible for what. And the capturing the village of Hendecourt had actually been given to men of the 8th Battalion, the King's Liverpool Regiment, and they did eventually successfully capture it, but very heavy casualties were inflicted during this. They broke through into the village at about 6:30 in the morning, and they did throughout the course of the day manage to successfully take the village of Hendecourt. as was so often the case and was the German sort of doctrine, was that if you lost any ground, you immediately counterattacked. And the Germans spent the rest of the day sort of trying to bomb the Canadians back out of the trenches. And it sort of descended into hand-to-hand fighting. But the Canadian Highlanders very, very sort of doggedly held on and did manage to resist all of these. But what happened was that about 5:30 in the afternoon, it became very apparent that there was large numbers of German reinforcements gathering along the Drocourt-Queant line. And obviously a counterattack was going to be launched. And this duly came at about 6 o'clock in the evening. And it came down the left flank of the Canadians. And the fortunate thing for the infantry was that they knew this attack was coming. And there was really good cooperation between the infantry and the artillery. And thankfully, the German counterattack was halted. It was during this counterattack that a man by the name of Private Claude Nunney of the 38th Canadian Infantry Battalion performed the action, or the first of his two actions that was to see him awarded the Victoria Cross, the first of the seven. He realised the precarious situation the men were in. He left his post at the company headquarters and managed to sort of scramble his way through this very, very heavy bombardment and kind of organised and led the men forward. And it was very, very brave actions, and it saved a really critical situation because the Canadians were in real danger of being overrun. And he continued this bravery into the actions of the 2nd of September, the following day, during the Canadian assault against the line. He was very, very badly wounded, but he refused to leave the field, and he positioned himself at the forefront of the advancing infantry. Often he was anywhere between sort of 50 and 100 metres ahead. And what he managed to do was sort of inflict very, very heavy casualties on German machine gunners, and he in fact killed on his own 25 German machine gunners, and he was seriously wounded a second time during this attack. And once again, he refused to leave the field. He became so weak that he had to be carried off the battlefield on a stretcher, and unfortunately he succumbed to his wounds some 16 days later. And it was for these actions on the 1st and 2nd that Nunney became the first of the seven Canadian Victoria Cross winners during the fighting. This was by no means the first time that he had showed exemplary bravery. In April 1917, Nunney had been awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal for stopping an attack by 20 Germans at Vimy Ridge, even though he was wounded at the time. And in the following June, he was actually awarded the Military Medal as well for being part of a successful attack against German trenches. And sadly, as I say, he succumbed to his wounds and he's buried in Aubigny on Artois Communal Cemetery. There was a lovely story that revolved around the taking of the Crow's Nest. When the position had been taken in the evening and successfully consolidated, a German officer arrived. He'd actually been on leave and had come back and didn't realise that the Crow's Nest had fallen into Allied hands. And he was taken prisoner by a Canadian officer called Captain Winifrith. And the German officer was in possession of a magnificent horse, and the horse was confiscated. And when the commanding officer of the Highlanders returned to duty, a man by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Charles Bent, he took a bit of a shine to this captured German horse, and he took it as his own and renamed him Fritz. And both Fritz and Lieutenant Colonel Bent would make it back to Canada at the end of the war. On the morning of the 2nd of September, the final Canadian assault against the Drocourt-Queant line went in, and things initially went quite well, but as always there were pockets of resistance, pockets of problems for the Canadians across the battlefield. And at one stage during the fighting, men of the 16th Canadian Infantry Battalion found themselves in a situation where they were held up by German machine gun fire, and it was clear that something needed to be done. So it was decided to call up the assistance of a tank to come and sort of break through the German lines and sort of end the German resistance. And the tank duly arrived, but the problem was that the tank driver couldn't actually see the infantrymen who were in sort of shell holes and on the ground in front of it. And this was clearly a very, very serious situation. And it was at this point a man by the name of William Metcalf, who was actually an American who was serving with the 16th Canadian Infantry, jumped out of the shell hole that he was taking cover in and managed to grab a signaller's flag. And he stood stood in front of the trench, in front of the tank rather, in full view of the enemy, and using his signal flag, he pointed the tank in the direction of the enemy trench, and he personally led the tank forward and along the trench. And of course, all the time this was happening, he was in full view of the enemy. He was being fired at with machine guns and rifles, and this act of sort of almost suicidal bravery did see him awarded the Victoria Cross. And when the men of the 16th Canadian Infantry finally occupied the trench, it was found that they actually had 17 machine guns that were firing on them at the time. And the battalion historian remarks, and quite understandably, that it really was a miracle how Metcalfe managed to avoid being killed. Now, he was wounded in this action, but he continued to advance with the battalion until eventually his wounds caused him to be ordered to take cover in a shell hole and have his injuries dressed. Metcalfe, as I say, was an American who had run away to Canada to join the war. And when his mother discovered what he's done, she was understandably very, very upset about this. And she actually contacted the Canadian and American officials in order to have him sent home. And by the time this arrived, he was on a troop ship halfway across the Atlantic on his way to England. And when he got to England, he was approached by a man called Walter Page, who was the U.S. ambassador to Great Britain at this time. And he, Page asked Metcalfe if he was the man Metcalfe whose mother had got involved in requesting that he would be sent home. And Metcalfe promptly stood to attention in front of the ambassador and simply said the word, "No, I'm not." And of course, you know, this there was nothing that the ambassador could do about it. And he actually managed to obviously see his way through the war. He survived and eventually went on to live a long and happy life before he died in 1968. It was earlier in the day before this event took place that another Victoria Cross was won by one of the great characters of Canadian military history, a man by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Cyrus Peck. He was in charge of the 16th Battalion when they ran into very, very heavy German resistance. And in disregarding his own safety, he went out and sort of reconnoitred the area ahead of his men. And he was being machine gunned at and sniper fired at all the time when this was happening. But he managed to go back to HQ, reorganized the battalion, and then successfully led his men forward, leading from the front. And whilst the men were pinned down and artillery fire was coming down, Peck realized that the problem was very, very serious. So he went and sought out the location of where some tanks could be found, and he was able to direct them towards the German strong points. And it was through this action that it was possible for the men to overcome resistance, and it paved the way for the another regiment to come through and help Peck's men secure the objective. Peck had had a distinguished military career. He'd fought throughout the Great War. He'd been very badly wounded at the Battle of Festubert in 1915, and he survived and was promoted to commander of the regiment in January 1916. He'd also been awarded a distinguished service order, and after the war, he went into politics, where he became a member of parliament for Skeena, British Columbia. And when his VC was announced, there was great sort of celebrations amongst the regiment, and a speech was made by the commanding officer, and the band struck up, and that sort of thing. He's a very distinguished looking man, Peck. If you ever find a picture of him, he's a very, very sort of impressive looking figure with a magnificent moustache. During his time in politics, he was very involved in veterans affairs, and he was actively involved in the local and state government. And he actually went on to serve as the aide-de-camp to two of the Canadian governor-generals, and he survived and died in September 1956. Down to the south of where this was going on, the 10th Canadian Infantry Battalion were involved in fighting near the village of Villers-lès-Cagnicourt. And it's about 3 miles to the southeast of the town of Vison-Artois. And there was an attack was launched on a German trench, which was unsuccessful. And the Germans sort of massed and prepared to open fire on the Canadians. They launched another attack. And it was at this point, a man by the name of Sergeant Arthur Knight led his men forward. They were being very heavily bombed at the time. They had grenades thrown at them left, right and centre. And he personally went in and engaged the enemy at close quarters, sort of hand-to-hand fighting. And although this was unsuccessful, Knight decided that something needed to be done. So he charged forward on his own once again and bayoneted to death several German machine gunners and mortar crews, and he forced the remainder of the men to retreat. And when they were retreating, he then ran back and grabbed hold of a Lewis gun and opened a fire on them as they were running away. And his men were able to come up and sort of consolidate the position. And it was at this point that Knight saw a party of about 30 Germans who were trying to escape into a deep sort of tunnel that had been dug into the lines. And he ran forward and didn't want them to get away. And he killed the officer and two NCOs, and on his own took 20 German soldiers prisoner. And later, as if this wasn't enough, later on that day, he routed another party of Germans that was trying to hold up his platoon's advance. And it was unfortunately during this third action that his luck ran out, and he was very, very seriously wounded and had to be taken off the battlefield on a stretcher. And sadly, he died the following day. And he lies at the moment buried in the beautiful Dominion Cemetery, which stands on top of the location of the DQ line at the time of the battle. The next two Victoria Crosses that were won during the fighting at the Drocourt-Queant line were actually awarded to men of the Canadian Medical Services. The first was awarded to a man called Bellenden Hutchison, and he was the medical officer for the 75th Canadian Infantry Battalion. And during the fighting, he displayed utmost sort of bravery and coolness, and he stayed on the battlefield to administer first aid and care to wounded soldiers. And of course, all the time he was doing this, he was being subjected to very fierce artillery and machine gun and mortar fire. And he dressed the wounds of a seriously wounded officer within sort of a point-blank range of the German trenches and was being shot at the time. And he actually succeeded in successfully evacuating the man back to safety. And they suffered very, very heavy casualties, the stretcher bearers and that sort of thing. And he then rushed back out onto the battlefield again to tend to a wounded non-commissioned officer. And once again, he managed to survive these wounds. And for this action and this bravery, he too was awarded the Victoria Cross. And the next VC, as I say, was won by a man called John Young. Now, he was a stretcher bearer for the 87th Canadian Infantry Battalion, and he was involved in the fighting near the ridge at Adjoy, which was just beyond the DQ line. And he was in a section of the battlefield that was utterly devoid of any form of cover whatsoever. So he was operating out in the open, and he was working as a stretcher bearer. And despite the sort of continuous rifle and machine gun fire that was coming at him, he ignored the danger and he tended to the wounded. And he unfortunately ran out of medical supplies, so he ran back to the Canadian positions, picked up more supplies, and went back out into no man's land again. And he stayed for over an hour tending to the wounded, and all the time he was being shot at, and he was exposed to sort of constant, very, very heavy fire. And once the village of Jury had actually been captured, he organized rescue parties and personally oversaw them going out to rescue wounded soldiers and bring them back in for treatment at the medical section. So a remarkable man, very brave. And for these incredible actions, he also was awarded the Victoria Cross. The final VC awarded to the Canadians that day was awarded to a man called Private Walter Rayfield. Now, he was a member of the 7th Canadian Infantry Battalion, and his men were being held up in no man's land by German machine gun fire. And he took the initiative, and he rushed single-handedly the enemy trench. He bayoneted two enemy soldiers and then took 10 prisoners. And he was then sort of pinned down by a sniper that was inflicting really heavy casualties on his company. And he managed to work out where the sniper was, and he single-handedly charged the section of German trench where the sniper was located. And the Germans were sort of so impressed, and I suppose I would say demoralized by his actions, that 30 of them surrendered to him, and it was he enabled his men to successfully take the trench. And later that day, he left the safety of his trench to go out into no man's land, and he tended the wounds of a badly wounded soldier all the time whilst he was being subjected to machine gun and rifle fire. General Sir Arthur Currie, in his personal memoirs, described the actions of the taking of the Drocourt-Queant line as one of the war's greatest triumphs. And I think it would not be an understatement to say that the actions of the Canadians were magnificent, and their capture of one of these vital sort of defensive systems allowed the Allies to advance a further 6 kilometres into German territory, and they successfully took up positions near their next objective, which was the Canal du Nord. And I think it's really testament to the scale of the fighting and the brutality of the fighting that so many Victoria Crosses were awarded to men of the Canadian infantry on that one single day. And quite rightly, the Canadian military looks on the 2nd of September 1918 as being one of the great days in its history. I hope you've enjoyed this latest episode of Footsteps of the Fallen with me, battlefield researcher, historian and writer Matt Dixon. And if you'd like to keep updated with what we are up to and what's happening, please don't forget to follow us on Twitter, where you can find us at footsteps_pod, or you can have a look on our Instagram feed, which is Footsteps of the Fallen blog, you'll find on Instagram. We've also got, obviously, our website, which you can find everything to do with the podcast and pictures and a blog and things like that. And you can find that at footstepsofthefallen.com. And if you have enjoyed what you are listening to and would like to help support the creative process, then please don't hesitate to do so. If you go to our website, footstepsofthefallen.com, and look at the page marked Support Us, you can either head to buymeacoffee.com/footstepspod and make a donation there, or you can go to patreon.com/footstepsofthefallen. And any help or assistance that you may be able to provide would be gratefully received. So all it leaves me now to do is to bid you farewell and thank you very much for your company as we continued our journey walking in the footsteps of the fallen. It's been a pleasure to have your company. Thank you and goodbye.